From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made right now. Donald Trump Jr. wrapping up his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee. It's happening behind closed doors, but it's widely understood that Trump Jr. will be asked about a couple of things in particular. First, the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, and second, his knowledge about the Trump Tower Moscow project. Now, my guest this hour is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post who focuses on the intersection of money and politics. Tom Hamburger directed his work to Trump and Russia pretty early on. His attention went there not necessarily because he was sifting through social media bots and campaign influence. Hamburger reports on money and related entanglements, and while so much attention is focused on what happened in relation to the election itself, Hamburger and some of his colleagues are looking at what projects are happening and where and who's involved and who stands to benefit or profit. And that's hardly the limit to Hamburger's work for The Washington Post. You might have seen his byline earlier this week on a story titled NRA money flowed to board members amid allegedly lavish spending by top officials and vendors. It's a look inside the culture of the NRA board, where board members and top executives have racked up lots of money and benefits. Well, this hour we welcome Tom Hamburger to the program to discuss his work and the state of investigative journalism, and it's great to have you, Tom. How are you?
Good. Doing well, Evan. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, and I want to tell our listeners, Tom was recently in the Rochester area speaking to students, I think, in Brighton last week, if I have my dates correct. Is that right, Tom?
Right. I'm a 1970 graduate of Brighton High School, and I got to go back to the to my alma mater last week and met with some of the outgoing and incoming editors and staff of the Trapezoid newspaper. So that was a thrill for me.
How much has changed?
Well, the school facility has been upgraded and dramatically in many ways, and also the demographics of Brighton have changed in a noticeable way since I graduated those several decades ago.
And what did you make of the conversations with students about their work for the Trap or just kind of the state of journalism now? What kind of questions were they asking?
So they asked terrific questions, and I was very impressed with them and met with some students and other classes as well. I was impressed at how well informed they are, how interested they are on the range of things, Evan, actually, that you mentioned at the top of the show. And also the journalism students in particular, or the Trapezoid staff, were interested in asking very probing questions about the state of journalism, the state of debate in the public square today, and also, of course, a vital question for anyone who's thinking of journalism as a career, which is what's happening and what's going to happen to news organizations, to newspapers going forward. And of course, there's no simple or clear answer to that, but we had a terrific discussion.
Yeah, and we'll get back to that a little bit later in the program, but I do want to ask you, Tom, if a student at Brighton or elsewhere asks you, hey, is this a career that you'd recommend to me, what do you generally say now?
So I'll tell you exactly what I said, which is to start out with the caveat that I can't predict the future. But one of the most exciting things that I'm aware of in this digital era, and we're all aware of it at the Washington Post and at every sort of legacy print news organization, that is this fact. We have more readers on our stories than we ever contemplated. We never believed it was possible in the past, because an important story circulates on the World Wide Web with such speed and intensity that we pick up readership, get feedback in an immediate and visceral way, in a way that I'd never experienced in previous decades. So one of the things we know from these extraordinary numbers of readers that we're seeing on important stories is that there is more demand, more interest than there's ever been before in a single story, and an ability to engage and to pull those stories, absorb them, and react to them. We haven't figured out how to monetize this digital environment yet. We, meaning the news organizations like the Washington Post, which I work for, we're profitable once again, but still haven't figured out how to take advantage of this enormous increase in readers that we're seeing and that we get around particular stories. I think, though, that is going to become more logical, more rational over time. And so my outlook is optimistic. I think the work is very important. The interest that I saw at Brighton among young people potential future journalist, was very keen. So I'm excited about it, and my approach is encouraging.
Well, when you talk about monetizing, I mean, I think the students you talk to, and frankly, not just students in high school, but a lot of adults who are probably under the age of 30 and maybe even under the age of 40, have kind of grown up in this internet age where you don't really want to pay for things. You'd like to read the Washington Post. You'd like to read the New York Times. You'd like to read a lot of different publications. But you don't really want to pay for the content. And, you know, we can't go back in time to the late 90s when these publications were making these decisions on whether or not to put up paywalls and what to do about that. But that is what is maybe most concerning to me. And I think in the last few years, we've had more of a call that is, you know, sort of this quasi-patriotic, this idea of subscribe to your paper if you care about your community, these kinds of calls. I don't know how well they're working for the state of the broader industry, but do you have any sense for how we can convince Americans to pay for journalism? Not just consume it, reading it, that's great, but to pay for it.
I have a great question, and you're absolutely right. There is a generation of readers who've grown up with the belief and the experience that they don't need to pay for the content, for the news that they are interested in. We're seeing a couple of positive signs. There is, as you suggested, this patriotic call to people to subscribe to newspapers, emphasizing that newspapers, news organizations in general, are vital to the success and the health of a democracy. For papers like the Washington Post, the New York Times, this is having a discernible effect. Our paid subscriptions are up. We are experimenting constantly with a paywall. We don't want to lose readers, but we would like to encourage them or to get into the habit of paying for the work we produce. It's an ongoing challenge, but there is some progress there. One of the things that we're finding at the Post is that people are willing to pay for, especially in an environment where news and information is so unfiltered, people are willing to pay at least a nominal amount for credible information, for a brand or for a promise that the information they're receiving is in fact coming from a reliable source, has been vetted in some way, and that they know, or it comes with a promise that there's not a political, in some cases, that there's not a political bias attached to it. So we're seeing national news organizations having some success with this. Washington Post, New York Times, particularly the Wall Street Journal. The sector of journalism that I worry about most are the local and regional papers, yeah, including the papers I grew up with in Rochester, because they, for reasons of economics and because of the advantages of the large national news organizations, have suffered some. This is a national effect, and you can see it in Albany, in Sacramento, in state capitals around the country. There's been a hollowing out of the regional coverage, which is so important as both to provide an informed citizenry with information, but also to serve as a watchdog on state and local government. And that's where my most serious area of concern is at the moment. What I mentioned at the top when I said this, we'll figure out a way to monetize this, is that in part given the predilections you talked about with the younger generation and accustomed to paying for it, we're still playing around with how the economics of news information, news distribution will work. Mm-hmm. And it's very complicated. Some of these questions are playing out now in some of the antitrust challenges to Google and other platforms that have thrived in part by taking advantage of the free news content which news organizations like ours offer.
My guest is Tom Hamburger, investigative reporter for The Washington Post. And if you want to call the program with questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. You can email the program, connections@wxxi.org, and you can call toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Tom's an investigative reporter at The Post and a Brighton High School graduate who recently spoke to students from his alma mater last week. And now we're talking about the work that that he has been doing for a number of years now for The Washington Post. That includes the question of what's happening, I think, at this hour. Donald Trump Jr. testifying for the second time in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee this hour. Is that right, Tom?
That's correct. At least when I went into the radio booth here at the Post, Don Jr. was still testifying behind closed doors before the Senate Intelligence Committee. So we don't have a readout from that panel. At least we didn't didn't see one in the last few minutes.
What's we mentioned off the top, just based on your own comments and reporting, what they're likely to be asking him about. What are the big questions that you think need to be answered?
So you did mention at the top, Evan, a couple of them. Since Don Jr. testified and testified at some length before this very panel more than a year ago, a lot of information has been made public, including some of the details in the Mueller report. And we expect that he will be asked about some of those specific details that have come to light. There are three that come to mind immediately. And one is the questions related to his knowledge about payments made by Michael Cohen to Stormy Daniels and other women, payments described by the New York prosecutor as hush money payments designed to prevent the bad news of Donald Trump having affairs with women outside with other women from becoming public during the campaign. Michael Cohen, you may recall, is actually in prison in Otisville, New York today, in part because he pleaded guilty to conspiring to break campaign finance laws by making payments that were campaign related to basically keep these women or their stories silent during the campaign. Michael Cohen was reimbursed for the payments that he made to those women and to the National Enquirer news organization, which was had a contract entitling it to publish the account of one of the women. And Cohen and the checks that the reimbursement checks that he received from the Trump Organization were co-signed by one Donald Trump Jr. So one of the questions that we expect Don Trump Jr. to be asked today is about that detail, unknown previously when he testified, that he in fact was a signatory to these payments described by the prosecutors in the Southern District of New York as hush money payments. Did he know about them, and can he inform the committee? Does he have more details about the alleged conspiracy that occurred?
Okay. In regards to the Trump family or the Trump corporation and Russia, obviously a lot of the talk when people hear Trump-Russia is the question of what the Mueller report looked into in regards to the influence in the campaign, the allegations of conspiracy, or more colloquially referred to as collusion. But your work takes a look at projects like Trump Tower Moscow. And I think some Americans are confused about what is allowed, or what should probably stop when it comes to money projects, monetary ties, when someone is running for office, what their company is doing. What do we know about Trump Tower Moscow? Tell us a little bit about what you have been finding there.
Yes, Evan, thanks for asking that. And in addition to the hush money payments, I think a second top-tier question that we expect Donald Trump Jr. to be asked about today is the project you just described, Trump Tower Moscow, which, if it had been built or had proceeded in 2016, was to have been the tallest building in Russia, one of the tallest buildings in the world. It was a lavish and significant project, which some members of the committee are eager to ask Donald Trump Jr. about, because the details of this project emerged again in detail in the last year before Donald Trump Jr. last testified. Specifically, the concerns are about not so much the legality, But you'll recall, but there are some obvious concerns that are raised by a presidential candidate engaging or seeking to conduct business overseas while running for president. Remember that this project proceeded and discussions around it proceeded, we now know, until mid-2016, a point during the campaign in which Donald Trump, then the presidential candidate, was making what seemed to those of us who are covering the campaign and those who are following it, surprisingly consistent, flattery of Vladimir Putin and knocking some of the longtime institutions like NATO, the European Union, which have been served in a sense as bulwarks against Russian aggression in Europe and around the world. So the coincidence of those two things is something that we felt at the time in 2016 was worth reporting and worth readers knowing about, voters considering as they went to the ballot box. But one of the things we faced throughout 2016 was a consistent denial of by the candidate and by his family that they were doing significant business with Russia or with Russians. And in fact, one of the things we've learned since, detailed in the Mueller report, detailed in reporting that has come out since, is that the Trump family, in fact, had extensive and persistent discussions with Russians, and a number of those discussions were about building a lavish and very ambitious Trump Tower in Moscow.
And so before we get to Matt in Rochester, Dan in Brighton on the phone, already the phone's ringing for investigative reporter from The Washington Post, Tom Hamburger. We'll get your calls in a moment, but I do kind of want to put a fine point on what Tom is saying here, which is that you know, the work that he has been and his colleagues have been doing regarding, for example, Trump Tower in Moscow doesn't necessarily find illegality. But there are questions about, you know, who benefits. And it's interesting that the Trump family had denied standing to benefit from those kinds of projects. All the while, you occasionally hear supporters of the president say, well, so what? He's a good businessman. He's allowed to use his influence. He's just smart. Anybody would do that. And some of your readers, Tom, might say, look, if you don't have anything that you've turned up that's illegal, you ought not be reporting it. And they might even point to the recent piece on the NRA. And if you don't mind, I'd like to quote some of your piece there, which I thought was exceptional work that you and your colleagues did under a recent headline regarding NRA money flowing to board members amid allegedly lavish spending by top officials and vendors. Tom and his colleagues write, quote, a former pro football player who serves on the NRA board was paid $400,000 by the group in recent years for public outreach and firearms training. Another board member, a writer in New Mexico, collected more than $28,000 for articles and NRA publications. Yet another board member sold ammunition from his private company to the NRA for an undisclosed sum. The NRA, which has been rocked by allegations of exorbitant spending by top executives, also directed money in recent years that went to board members, the very people tasked with overseeing the organization's finances. In all, 18 members of the NRA's 76-member board, who are not paid as directors, collected money from the group during the past 3 years, according to tax filings, state charitable reports, and NRA correspondence reviewed by The Washington Post. Later in the piece, you write, you quote a gentleman named Douglas Varley, a Washington attorney who specializes in tax-exempt organizations and reviewed the NRA's federal and state filings, for The Washington Post, who told you, quote, in 25 years of working in this field, I have never seen a pattern like this. The volume of transactions with insiders and affiliates of insiders is really astonishing, end quote. But Varley said he did not see any apparent violations of the law and noted that the NRA, for the most part, appeared to have properly disclosed the payments. He closed by saying, but the pattern raises a threshold question of who the organization is serving. Is it being run for the benefit of the gun owners in the country and the public, or is it being run as a business generating enterprise for officers and employees of the organization, end quote. So look, Tommy, you're going to have readers who say, yeah, you did a big expose in the NRA and you found out they're doing nothing illegal, that they're disclosing what they're doing and it's all within the law. You're going to have readers who say, yeah, you're doing these exposés on the Trump family and all the benefits they're getting from dealing with Russians, but it's legal. And what's your rejoinder to them who say, kind of, you know, if you've got something illegal, tell us. If not, you know, no one's doing anything wrong here.
A couple of things, and thank you for the question, Evan. One is that I would remind your listeners in this specific case of that the president's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, is in jail and was convicted and pled guilty to lying about that Trump Tower Moscow project. He said that it ended early in 2016, covering up the fact that the negotiations and the discussions about building this giant tower, preliminary though they were, extended into the middle of the campaign year. And for that, he is serving prison time for lying under oath. And so one of the reasons to both recall reader attention to that history is that we now have the president's son who will be asked similar questions. He also testified about the timing of the work on that project and his knowledge of it. And he too, this is one of the things we suspect the committee will be looking for, could be subject to perjury if his answers previously, a perjury charge as Michael Cohen was, if his answers previously were not truthful. I hasten to add, we don't have an indication that that is the case, but I wanted to point out that there are criminal charges related to these business deals that have landed people in jail. It has to do more not with the initial action itself, but with the cover-up of that action. Second, I wanted to point out that while it is not illegal for a presidential candidate to engage broadly in business activities around the globe, especially someone like Donald Trump, who is known as an international businessman, the rules change once someone becomes an elected official. And there are both specific rules and constitutional limitations on the international financial activities that a president and that a member of his cabinet can engage with. Some of them are related to disclosure and some are flat out prohibitions, so there is legality involved. And the final thing, Evan, I'd want to state is that as citizens and as newspaper reporters and actually as members of Congress, the standards for us are not the same as those that would apply in a court of law or by a prosecutor attempting to determine whether a specific violation of law had occurred. We're engaged in something much more subjective as voters. Is the behavior that we're observing appropriate for an elected leader? Does it reach a point does there become a point where the behavior or the cumulative behavior is offensive in such a way that a person should be removed from office? Of course, that occurs very infrequently, but there is a constitutional provision, impeachment, to undertake removal of a person from office, and it's the obligation of a news organization, as opposed to a prosecutor, to lay out as much information for the public and for lawmakers as possible.
I love it. I think Tom's phone is blowing up because he's an investigative reporter and you probably have sources calling you all day long. So I'm really enjoying this conversation with Tom Hamburger from The Washington Post. By the way, before we grab those phone calls from listeners, Tom, just on the NRA story, you know, again, I know you're going to have NRA members or defenders of the organization say, see, at least the Washington attorney who specializes in tax-exempt organizations told you that what they're doing, they're allowed to do. Is it the same kind of points that you're making there in regards to the Trump family that, okay, it's technically legal, but is this appropriate for the organization, and is this a question of who they're really serving?
So, Evan, thank you. And two points. One is that in reporting on nonprofit institutions, and those are institutions that through the tax code are granted special benefits because they are providing a public good, either public education, serving the public interest in some way, and they're not and it's an organization not seeking to enrich itself. So we as news organizations locally and nationally also see as part of our watchdog responsibilities, looking not only at government officials and government institutions, but also other institutions that affect our lives. That can mean private institutions, private corporations, and especially those who are given a public advantage, like the significant tax breaks that flowed to nonprofits like the National Rifle Association, or I might add the United Way or other organizations. We feel a special role to look over those. Specifically on the NRA, I'd remind you that the legal experts we contacted and basically went to review the complex tax documents we saw, said that while there was not an open and shut case of a tax violation here, they did say that the pattern of self-enrichment by board members and top officials raises a fundamental question. And the fundamental question is, does the organization, is its purpose providing services to its members and to the public, or is its purpose something more private, that is, providing personal, private gain for its officers? If it's the latter, it would be illegal and the organization could lose its tax-exempt status. And that's one of the open questions, I would say, that's under discussion now about the National Rifle Association.
Tom Hamburger, investigative reporter at The Washington Post. If you are on the phone, Matt in Rochester, Dan in Brighton, we'll get to your calls first after this only break of the hour. We'll take some of your emails, too. And if you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK, it's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Coming up in our second hour, Gilbert Metcalf is our guest. He's the author of a new book called Paying for Pollution: Why a Carbon Tax is Good for America. A carbon tax is often discussed as one of the most likely policy ideas regarding climate action. If it actually happens, what does it look like? How does it work in practice? What are some of the pitfalls and how to get around them? Gilbert Metcalf tries to answer all of those questions next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Matt in Rochester, first on the phone with Washington Post investigative reporter Tom Hamburger. Go ahead, Matt.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Tom. I want to kind of go back to the local journalism you were talking about earlier.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
How basically, you know, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Internet essentially is, you know, it's hard for these local newspapers to, I mean, they can't make money selling ads and people aren't buying these newspapers as you were talking about. Have you heard of Andrew Yang? He's running for the Democratic nomination for 2020. He has a specific policy. It's called a local journalism fund. He wants to give $1 billion to operate out of the FCC, which would give grants to local communities of anywhere from $25,000 to $250,000 to media outlets. What are you guys' thoughts about that idea?
Tom, you want to start?
Well, so I'm aware, of course, of Andrew Yang's candidacy, and I am familiar with his idea. And I, rather than endorsing it, I would just say that I applaud the notion of proposing innovative ways to think about financing the publicly important service of providing information to listeners, viewers, readers, adds up to citizens on a local as well as a national basis. And I so appreciated his raising that proposal because I do think what's happened, particularly to news organizations and particularly to newspapers on the local and regional level, is something of a crisis for our democratic institutions and those institutions on the local level. So I applaud his calling attention to the problem most heartily, and whether specific grants is the way to go or not, I don't know, but I'm so glad that he is making it part of the debate.
Yeah, I will agree with Tom there, Matt, and thank you for the phone call. Certainly, Andrew Yang has raised a number of interesting ideas that at least have spurred conversation about whether it's universal basic income or, yeah, you're right, this idea on policy that might impact the preservation of local media and news outlets. I am a fan of the public radio model, which should come as no surprise to anybody. But at the same time, I'm sensitive to the fact that right now the trend is not a good one, especially in the way of print, and I'm very concerned about that. So Matt, thanks for that, and I think for our listeners, it's good to sort of keep in touch with what those proposals are. Pretty easy to find if you want to Google for Andrew Yang and find more about what he's been proposing. So thank you, Matt. Dan in Brighton is next on the phone with a Brighton graduate, Tom Hamburger from the Washington Post. Go ahead, Dan.
Since Mr. Hamburger left Brighton High School, they have developed a in-house television program that does the morning report. I wonder if Mr. Hamburger was informed of them and if he visited those people that are running the morning television report.
Tom?
Oh, the morning show.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. So I did hear about it while I was there. I did not, unfortunately, get a chance to visit their studios or learn a great deal about it. But it was impressive to me that that television show is being broadcast. And I thought it was, and I applauded it as an innovation at the high school, which is a place and bigger both as an institution and as a physical plant than when I attended several decades ago. So I thought it was really cool and wish that I had a chance to explore it further. One of the things that excited me about it is that I've been talking some because I work for the Washington Post about print journalism, and wanted to let your listeners know that we are also changing or starting to see ourselves very differently, so that journalism or communications, as it is at Brighton High School, same as at the Washington Post, it's no longer just about producing a print publication, an online publication. It's also about video, broadcast, podcasts. I'm in a radio booth at the Washington Post because we now realize and appreciate the power of radio also, and are starting to think of ourselves as a multi-platform news organization, not just a newspaper.
All right, thank you for the phone call, Dan. John in Fairport. John, go ahead.
Hey, guys, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I just had tuned in and caught the last part before the break, speaking to nonprofits and, you know, enriching themselves as opposed to, you know, doing whatever good their goal might be for the public. And, you know, I'm skeptical of a lot of nonprofits for that reason. Is there a dollar amount that is set above which, officers and board members, you know, can't earn? Because that's really what would need to be done is to say, you know, okay, X amount of dollars we deem acceptable for your skills and talents to run this nonprofit, but you know, you go above that and you're really you're in it for some other reason.
Yeah, John, thanks. That's a good question. Tom?
I appreciate that question. So in the course of working on this NRA story, I did learn some about the tax laws governing tax-exempt organizations. My understanding is that the laws are not do not prohibit what are called, related party transactions. What the law requires is that they be disclosed, to the IRS and for nonprofits. The IRS tax forms called Form 990 are generally available online for public review and for news organizations like mine, Evan, and like yours to review. The question that's raised is not about whether a specific contract exceeds a permissible limit, but the requirement is A, that it be disclosed, and B, IRS regulators look to see whether there is some review of these disclosed transactions, typically by an independent board or an audit committee of the board. One of the concerns that the story in the Washington Post about the NRA ran this last weekend is that a fairly high percentage of the board, a quarter or more, were receiving financial benefits through these related party transactions. And so it raises the question, which could become a legal threshold question, of whether the board is serving independently to oversee those disclosed transactions and to make sure that the money and that the money is being spent and the organization is operating in the interests of its members and in the general pursuit of the organization's public purpose. If it is determined by the IRS that the pattern reveals that the organization is in fact supporting rather than a public purpose, the private money-making activities of a board or a small group of high-level officials, then the tax-exempt status could be withdrawn. And there are cases, including some in the news recently, where that has happened.
Tom, when you and your colleagues decide to investigate, for example, the NRA and its board and where money is going, what prompts that kind of investigation? I'm curious if it is the rather public spat between Wayne LaPierre and Oliver North, the CEO and the outgoing president, who've been trying to kind of undermine each other. I don't know if that had anything to do with it or something else.
Yeah, thank you, Evan. So, yes, we were I was pulled from covering the ongoing congressional inquiries and the response from the Trump administration to look at the NRA a couple of weeks after that very public spat occurred at the NRA convention at the end of April and continuing through the beginning of May between Oliver North, the president, then president of the NRA, and the organization's longtime CEO, Wayne LaPierre. And it brought out into the public light the charges and countercharges of mismanagement and self-enrichment. And we felt that to serve our readers and the public, we needed to get a handle on these charges and attempt to discern what it might mean for the organization itself. I hasten to add also, I wanted to tell you the NRA has responded to our story specifically, saying A, that the organization is defending many of the controversial expenditures and saying that in our story we lacked a complete understanding of the operation of the organization. They noted, among other things, that there is a small and sometimes what might be considered inside group of contractors who get many of the high dollar contracts at the NRA. And they say that in part occurs because the organization is under siege and that outside organizations and opinion writers are encouraging a boycott of the organization, and so it's a matter of necessity. If I could just jump in, Evan, with one other case that sort of preceded the NRA for us, but that the Washington Post sort of specialized in looking at. It's a tax-exempt organization called the Trump Foundation. I do not mean to compare the two, but I wanted to let you know that we were interested and have developed expertise on our staff that we didn't have as finely tuned previously because my colleague David Fahrenthold at the Post has for the last several years, starting in 2016, been looking at the operation of the Trump Family Charity. And they were investigated by the same New York State Attorney General, because they're domiciled in New York, that is now investigating the NRA. And you may recall that the Attorney General's office found some concern about the way that charity was operated and that it has since closed its doors.
Speaking of what else is domiciled in New York, you know, there's a lot of attention on Mueller, this investigation, and I think just the nature of the buildup to the release of the report and the ensuing conversations, debates about what it said or what Mueller was sort of signaling with his testimony, it seems maybe to the American people that this was it in the way of looking in terms of prosecutorially at Donald Trump or his family or his administration. I suspect the Southern District of New York will maybe have some things to say. What do you expect in the future out of that, Tom?
So if the question is specifically about the Southern District of New York, we do know that they have they and other U.S. attorneys' offices have ongoing investigations, close to 20, I think, that in one way or another have spilled out from the Mueller report. So we will continue to see ongoing legal action, likely some additional indictments and so forth, that will continue to inform and fill in our knowledge of what happened in 2016, and also what if those cases proceed, how certain actions which may have raised caught the interest of law enforcement agencies and prosecutors, how they intersected, if they did, with the Trump organization and Trump family members.
Tom, I saw an appearance you made earlier this year on MSNBC in which you were talking about Roger Stone, and that appearance struck me for several reasons, not the least of which is the question of how reporters have to deal with the impact of their reporting and uncovering facts and the possibility that, that what you uncover might not sort of even dent those who you would think would be either chastened in some way or another. And yesterday on this program, one of our callers complained that that there's a lot of emphasis on Donald Trump and his administration, and him in particular, on his untruthful nature. And the caller was saying, well, look, Barack Obama lied, and Hillary Clinton lied, and which, by the way, is true. I mean, every human being lies. Almost every human being lies every day in some small fashion. It's been studied. It should probably chasten all of us. But the difference is when there are significant lies in which people are caught, there's usually a price for that. I'm not always talking criminally or people losing jobs, but politically, socially, there's usually a price. Whereas now, when the president says after he's elected, you know, he wins by the biggest margin in decades or the biggest margin in a century as a Republican, and it turns out it's not true, and reporters tell him it's not true, and the next day he goes to a rally and says the same thing, it just doesn't matter what's true or not. He's going to make whatever he wants to be true. And when you were talking about Roger Stone on MSNBC, it kind of hit me in the same way that, well, Roger Stone was caught lying, but then he says, well, obviously I was kidding and you all should have known that. And, you know, frankly, a lot of people who like him and support him say, yeah, that's right, as opposed to saying there's not like a shared set of facts anymore as I can discern it. That's what kind of scares me the most. And I wonder how you see that.
Evan, so glad you raised that. It's a really important question, a big deal to us. We talk about it frequently in this newsroom at the Washington Post. You know, I was a reporter in Washington and grew up with the famous quote from former New York State Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, reverberating in Washington, that individuals are entitled to their own opinion, but not to their own facts. And that phrase was repeated again and again in debates all over the country and on the Senate floor. And it underlines something that strikes me as so critical to the functioning of a democracy or a rational debate, which is that to have a discussion, we have to have some underlying agreement on basic information and understanding of what's true and what isn't true, so that we can marshal these facts and information in a logical debate. And if we lose that reliance or ability to trust that there are some immutable facts or information that can form the basis of a debate, it means we won't have a debate. And without debate, without a rational discussion and a critical discussion, we can't rationally identify common problems and figure out how to solve them. And that, by the way, is the definition of politics. Politics is often an ugly word, but it's what I remembered learning, in fact, from my teachers at Brighton High School. Politics is the way a group of individuals identify common problems and seek ways to resolve them peacefully. The lying is so prevalent that we now have a project at the Washington Post of trying to track any misstatements. We count them up when we compare presidential misstatements by the month and by administration.
All right, let me get Jack in Greece on the phone next with investigative reporter from the Washington Post, Tom Hamburger. Go ahead, Jack.
Thanks, Evan. Tom, first, thank you so much for the work that you and the Washington Post do. It's so critical. And you saved me some time because you just made the point that I was going to make about agreeing on facts. But the one thing that sticks in my mind, too, is related to what you've talked about is I think a similar story is where we see doctors that are paid large sums of money by for endorsing medical procedures or particular drugs, but that never comes to light until somebody investigates it and shines a light on it. So people realize, hey, these doctors are getting paid, you know, in some cases up to $1 million simply to endorse a drug. So, but the other thought that I have is in today's environment, with the constant drumbeat of fake news and discrediting of investigative journalism and newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post. But in my opinion, it almost seems like today that news organizations like yours are outgunned in terms of we have the White House that's got a megaphone that they're able to use. And it just seems like that kind of drowns out the message of, wait a minute, what are the facts here? So thanks for taking my call.
Jack, thanks for the phone call. You want to add to that, Tom?
Jack, thank you. It is the equation that you just described is something also that we talk about here all the time, because part of our role for decades, maybe for centuries, as news organizations, was to try to ferret out the truth and expose distortions of truth or lies when they occurred. It used to be, it seems to me, it's true that politicians lie. Franklin Roosevelt was called a chameleon on plaid for the number of times that he changed his positions on things. But it seems to me that the acceptance of offering outright falsehoods has reached a level we have never seen before. I can only tell you our approach at the Washington Post, and this is, we're encouraged to sort of think this way by Marty Baron, who's the editor of the Post, is to stay on it, to continue to insist on the truth. We've expanded our staff. We have a little unit here called Fact Checker, which looks at statements by public officials, Republican, Democrat, nonpartisan civil servants, but people in public life, and we seek to determine how close their statements and claims adhere to the known factual record. We are up over 10,000 misstatements from this president. It's an astonishing number. Sometimes we even get hundreds in a single weekend. But our feeling is that that it's important to maintain a sort of watchdog role on public statements and on public officials across the ideological spectrum, and that we need to continue to do so, even if it appears that revealing the falsehoods does not obtain an immediate result.
Tom, last listener question comes from a listener named Alex, who emails, why does the news media spend so much time investigating Trump while it spent so little time investigating Obama? That's why conservatives like me don't trust the Times or the Post. That's from Alex.
So I appreciate that question from Alex. I was an investigative reporter at the Post during the Obama era, and also was assigned and spent most of my effort during 2016 examining the claims and the financial activities of Hillary Clinton. So what I would say in response is that we do our best to hold public officials accountable regardless of political party. I am aware and keenly aware of the concerns that have developed that mainstream news organizations are falling into partisan camps, including my own news organization, and it distresses me greatly, and it distresses others at the Washington Post, and it's something that we seek to overcome, asking folks like your caller to take a look at our record, review our coverage of Hillary Clinton, compare it, and come back and also engage with us and tell us how we can improve.
And I would just say to Alex, the premise of the question implies that every administration would have an equal number of possible scandals or wrongdoing, which is not true. But also, it implies that there was no coverage of investigative coverage during the Obama years or the Clinton years. I would say the Clinton years when she was as Secretary of State. Of course, not true. So, but I appreciate that, Alex, and we always appreciate the questions and the chance to interact with people like Tom Hamburger, who has been our guest for the hour, an investigative reporter for The Washington Post, a Brighton graduate who recently spoke to students at Brighton and took the time for us this hour. Tom, thank you very much. I know it is always busy, and my guess is you're diving right back into work at The Washington Post. But here at Connections, our listeners greatly appreciate your time and your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan. Good to be with you.
Tom Hamburger coming to us from The Washington Post for the hour. Short break, more Connections coming up.